from the Sky News Centre at 5.
Protect and defend.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
The Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President. Yeah!
Donald Trump has just become the 45th President of the United States of America. Well, earlier, the chairman of the Inauguration Committee, Senator Roy Blunt, reminded the crowd of previous pledges that had been made.
In the middle of the Depression, the country was told that the only thing we had to fear was fear itself. And President Kennedy talked about the obligation in democracy to country. The great question that day was, ask what you can do for your country.
Well, earlier, Mr. Trump and his wife Melania had tea with the Obamas. The outgoing president told reporters, of course, he was feeling nostalgic as he left the Oval Office for the final time in the role. Well, thousands of people are celebrating the inauguration in Washington, but huge numbers of anti-Trump protesters are also there. Around 500 activists wearing black, some with their faces covered, marched through the city. Some of them smashed shop and car windows and fought with police in riot gear, who responded with pepper spray and stun grenades. Our main news: Donald Trump has become the 45th president of the United States. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gover.
Bristol.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling helping me review this week's news. It's Cabinet Member for Transport, Labour Councillor for Bedminster, Mark Bradshaw. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, as a new Emperor and Commander-in-Chief is sworn in at the helm of the Empire, we ask, is the President really in charge? Or is this all theatre? By surrounding himself with bankers and oil men, who many see as more loyal to their private Council on Foreign Relations club than the American people, will it just be business as usual? We hear what to expect from Trump and what to watch out for from former military advisor to the United Nations tonight. Also, as former IRA commander Martin McGuinness's ill health forces an election in Northern Ireland, we look back at steak knife, vital lessons slowly being learnt from the Troubles. That the British Army were not only executing senior Republicans, including lawyers, they were making key life and death decisions at the heart of the IRA itself. Several provos who thwarted British Army plans were executed. So, how many IRA terror attacks were carried out under orders of the British Army? And what are the implications today? If Britain is the scene of an ISIS terror attack, might that be masterminded too by the forces? Or criminals within the armed forces of our so-called allies? Just how far down does this particular rabbit hole go? Plus, it's Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots, all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of -2, frost and patchy fog in the morning. This weekend, though, highs around 7 Celsius, sunnier and colder on Saturday, warmer but cloudy on Sunday. Next week, highs of around 10 Celsius, plenty of sunny spells. Next weekend, 28th and 29th of January, Highs of 10 Celsius, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Cabinet Member for Transport, Labour Councillor for Bedminster, Mark Bradshaw. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. Hello.
Yes, I suppose we ought to start, really, by talking about the announcement you made today. Not the transport. We'll leave that for a minute. But what are they?
Well, there's been a planning application under consideration for a new cycle route and other works in Victoria Park in South Bristol. It's been a very contentious issue. Lots of concerns raised. And I really want to bring an end to the division. So I've withdrawn the planning application. And I want to bring the community together to find a better way to get this route in place.
What have been the main problems then? I mean, a cycle route doesn't sound too contentious.
Lots of concern about conflict. So conflict, particularly in Victoria Park, between residents, children going to school, and people cycling. Some issues around previous, you know, antisocial behaviour in the park, motorcycles and so on, and some changes that were being proposed to the entrance gate. So lots of local issues which were just making it really difficult to reach a common agreement locally. And you know, the park has to work for all users, and the cycle route must work for all those, not just committed cyclists, but people who, you know, would quite like to cycle but are worried about cycling on roads. So I think it's the best thing to do. It gives time to find a better approach, bring the community together, working with some of the local councils as well.
What about this issue with the police in Hartcliffe?
Well, there's a very small minority of drivers who are just trying their luck. So, for example, there are diverted routes. There's safe routes for people to walk. Particularly, there's part of Novus Hill, which is one of the diversion routes that doesn't have a pavement. So there's been a protected pathway installed. And there's some drivers who have just been ignoring the signs, ignoring the red lights, doing U-turns through red lights. It's a small minority of drivers. I've been speaking to the police today about encouraging those drivers just to obey the signs. They're there for the safety of all, you know, road users, pedestrians and others. So it's about encouraging drivers to stick to the rules of the road. The quicker we can get the works done, the quicker the contractors can get off site. So I think a bit of police presence might actually help things as well. I'm very grateful for all that they've been doing.
So is that going to happen? Is there going to be police lurking there?
Well, police have already been there, so the police have already been on site on and off during this week. There are also some cameras being installed, and I think you can expect to see some more police presence over the coming weeks. I say it's a very, very small minority of drivers who are just doing things which are unsafe, and the signs are in place, the diversions are in place, and what we want are the works to be done, but we want everything to be safe. So that's why the police, I think, are being very helpful in coming on site and just I guess encouraging drivers just to be safe.
So do you ever see yourself as Cabinet Member for Roadworks?
Well, I think we've exhausted our supply of cones in this city. I see myself as helping to bring investment into the city, helping to renew our infrastructure, which has been long underfunded, building a better public transport network that we can be proud of as a city that other cities have already got.
I mean, we're not going to be proud of this metro bus, Mark, are we? It's a half-baked attempt to do a tram, which we failed to do, and the metro bus, actually, most people I've spoken to, maybe you know better, say it's actually not going to do a lot to change congestion in the city.
It's not a silver bullet, but by any means, but 90% of people who travel by public transport travel by bus. So having a more efficient, effective and easy to use public transport system based around the bus is the best option for the city. And other cities have come to that conclusion.
But why didn't we get a tram? Just
well,
explain
you,
that.
A, the cost of it. B, the sheer scale of works to actually put one in place. So it's the cost, it's the disruption. You look at Edinburgh, for example, which has had the disruption for many years, to introduce what is a fairly small-scale tram route. You know, I go to places that have got trams, They're not really crowded. There's still traffic congestion. So I think our priority here is to invest in rail, and obviously we want to do more in terms of our local rail infrastructure, but make sure that our bus network actually works a lot better than it does. Metrobus should play a really big part in that.
Now, Cambridge has got one of these guided busways. I noticed it didn't take very long for locals to put up a website called No Guided Bus, and their main article on there is Misguided and Bust. The misguided busway, and apparently there were quite a lot of accidents, and not as anywhere near as many people using it as they thought the projected were to use it.
It's a very different route, Tony. It's a form of railway line. I've been to see it. Goes through countryside. Ours is an urban scheme and therefore more complicated, more unpredictable in terms of what you find when you dig up the road, and much more complex to put together. The Cambridge scheme actually has had a 300% increase in passenger numbers, and most of the other rapid transit schemes that I've come across have seen growth in passenger numbers because they go where people want to travel, so they're planned to meet travel needs. A lot of our bus network at present is rather outdated. Parts of the city are really underserved. For example, in East Bristol, have very poor links with public transport. So in time, Metrobus, I think, is going to unblock this.
Now, have you been to Nancy in France?
No, I haven't, actually.
Because they had a misguided... Well, they could, actually, this is on the lightrailnow.org website, quite so reprehensible as the previous one I mentioned. But they introduced, in the early noughties, a guided bus there. It lasted around about a year before they just gave up on it and built a tram instead on the same track.
Yeah, well, that could be the case, but I know in Britain there are about 50 cities, towns and cities, that are working on or have already implemented rapid transit, so BRT-type schemes, very similar to our Metrobus, so we can learn from what they've done, what they got right and what didn't go so well. You know, we are not alone in this.
Do we have an operator for Metrobus yet?
We're talking to a number of operators. I can't tell you who we're talking to, but
I
we are talking,
talking
to a
first.
Number.
Talking
we're
first,
talking to a number of companies. They're, because of the way the bus market operates, these will be commercial services. So we have to ensure that they are going to deliver what the passenger needs. And we have set some very clear specifications around Metrobus in terms of the vehicle, things like ticketing, and also fares as well.
I mean, say, for example, some cheapskate company came along who employed drivers that weren't properly trained, drove too fast, drove their trams off the rails. Would you consider employing somebody like that or allowing someone like that to run this Metrobus?
I mean, there's really strong conditions that are attached to the Metrobus operating agreement.
So first group won't be one of the contenders because they were the operators of the fatal tram crash in Croydon, weren't they?
I think that's still being investigated by the rail
inspection authority. Well, I think most people know what happened. They were going much too fast around a corner, and the tram tipped over. The guy was running the thing something like three times the maximum speed for that part of the track.
It's still the case also that the traffic commissioner is responsible for issuing public service vehicle licences, and the traffic commissioner actually has more powers than local councils. So we're talking to a number of operators. There's been strong commercial interest in the Metrobus routes.
Could I suggest to you, for our safety, that you don't award the contract to First, since they've just had this fatal accident in Croydon?
We're talking to a number of operators, as I said. I'm confident that actually when Metrobus starts operating later this year, it will result in a big difference to how people travel around the city, because there are some journeys, including from my own patch up to the North Fringe, say for Filton, which are very difficult to do by public transport. And I've got constituents saying to me, I have to drive because there's no other way for me to get to work. Well, Metrobus might just provide that option.
So when are we going to see the first ones running?
Later this year. So in the
which
summer
part
autumn.
Of the routes? Yeah, which part?
So you'll see AVTM, which is the Ashenvale to Temple Meads route, come along probably first, and work is progressing on that really, really well. And the swing,
that's the route
skew
right
bridge,
near you, where you live.
but it's also quite a short route and connects into the park and ride. The skew bridge being built on Winstoke Road is coming along very, very well. South Bristol Link is open, and there will be services on South Bristol Link, and the Metrobus stops on there have already been built. I saw them when we opened that route on Monday. And the last route, which is the longest route and, you know, more complicated because it involves the city centre, involves the works up on Stoke Lane, the Bus-only junction over the M32, the bus lane on part of the M32, and the works in South Bristol, that would be probably the last bit. But that's the longest route. So in all, we're talking about 31 miles of route, 9 bridges, extensive underground works, so extensive drainage works.
When's the M32, really when's the M32 city centre route and up to
the north
of Bristol?
Route.
Yeah,
when's in the autumn. In the autumn, but that is the longest and most complicated bit of all. And say the Hartcliffe Way works are the last sort of major chunk of that that we've got to do.
Now, we've had a horrendous amount of congestion, not only in the city centre but up on the M32 for quite a long time. Yeah. Mark, have you actually sat down and done the figures as to whether it's going to save people's journey times, this metro bus, by getting rid of congestion any more than the amount it's added to everyone's journey times while it's been being built?
Well, a lot of the works on the M32 are by Highways England. They're safety works to improve the safety barrier and do other works on the M32. The M32, although it's a very short motorway, has a lot of long-term legacy issues. And I know Highways England, because I talk to them on a regular basis, are committed to investing in that route. So all we're doing on the M32 is putting a bus lane up part of it. The bus-only junction has already been built. So a lot of the M32 works are not our doing, but the road needs improving. It's a really key strategic route. As I said, Metrobus is not a silver bullet. It's not going to sort our traffic problems.
What about?
But I think it will make a difference.
What about ticketing? Are people going to be able to use tickets that are all-day tickets on the Metro bus as well? A lot of people, of course, they come into work on public transport, but they maybe want to go to the shops, maybe in the cinema or something before they go home.
Yeah. We're keen to have
a whole range. No.
Well, I'm being really clear about what I'm saying here, in that we don't cash on Metro bus because it holds up the bus, so we would not have cash payment on the bus.
So you're with the first group on this getting rid of cash. So even if you've got £2-3 in your pocket, you can't get on the bus.
Well, I think in London they don't allow cash.
A lot of people don't like it in London either. This affects the poorest people much more. If you're wealthy and you've got a bank account, that sort of thing, you can get on the bus. If you haven't got a bank account, you can't use the bus.
Well, let me finish a moment. So we won't have cash on Metro bus. Each of the Metro bus stops will have a ticket machine there where you can buy a ticket, and you'll be able to buy a whole range of different tickets. We're also looking at a pay-as-you-go card and card as well. And we're also looking at a pay-as-you-go card. We're looking at payment by app as well. And we're looking at contactless payment, because these are very popular. But they
insecure.
Also speed up the bus.
They're insecure as well. This contactless is incredibly insecure.
Well, look, I go by what the banking industry and our experts say, and I'm not a banking expert, but I do know that the bus moves faster when you've not got somebody on there trying to get change for a £20 note on a Monday morning. I also know that people, you know, want to pay if they've got a smartphone, and I've met some people who haven't got them. You know, they want to pay by app, they want to pay by Apple Pay and all these other things. And that's actually good, because what it does is it removes one of the barriers to public transport. You know, those people who perhaps don't use the bus often are worried about getting on the bus and not knowing what the fare is, not knowing what the route is, and therefore they're put off. There's plenty of evidence to actually show that. So removing some of these barriers, making it easy for people to plan journeys, know where the bus is going, and to pay for their journey, will mean more people end up using the bus. And
well, I'm sure you're old enough to remember something called a conductor.
Well, they're long gone, aren't they? Long gone.
Well, not even on the trains. They're trying to get rid of them,
Metro bus here, but Metro bus is going, I think, to make a difference in Bristol. It's not going to sort our problems, but I think people will be pleasantly surprised when it comes into operation, because it will. I think it will make some journeys much, much easier.
So, when you're deciding on who gets this contract, is it people who say, "Oh, we just want people to buy tickets on this bus, not through tickets"? Will any of those people stand a chance of getting the contract or not?
Well, the specification is a very extensive one, so it covers things like the vehicle type, the frequencies, the routes, the type of ticketing, the type of payment. Yeah, it's very, very extensive indeed. So we, as a partnership, it's not just me that's going to be sat there, it's going to be my three colleagues from the other authorities advised by our officers. But I think what we just want to see is a good quality service and operation that meets our specifications. Now, they've achieved it elsewhere. Okay, they've got more powers in London, but actually I think we can achieve a better deal for passengers here as well.
What about the spiralling costs? Because it's going up. It keeps going up, doesn't it? Every time we hear it's a little bit more, it's going to cost us a bit more. I think, just looking for the latest figures, £216 million pounds now. And the last time we heard, a year ago, it was 200. So that's another £12 million it's costing. Yeah. Why is that?
Well, I think there's a really simple answer in that we're doing some complex things. So, you know, you're digging holes in the road, you're building bridges, you're sorting out drainage, you're doing some very complex road building.
But we knew we were going to have to do that.
But you always have a contingency. And if you go back to 2010, the coalition government reduced the contingency levels in all major capital projects. So we now find, like many other places do, that for these big schemes, we don't have much contingency. And things happen on the ground that you haven't planned for. You know, but on a larger scale from doing some work on your home and finding that you need to spend a bit more to get a problem fixed, these problems that we've encountered, so gas mains in the wrong place, extra drainage works and so on, cost many hundreds of thousands of pounds. So they're not cheap to do. But we've got to do it right, because this infrastructure has to be resilient for the long term.
I mean, the track record of government with these contracts is not good, is it? I mean,
But it's a lack of contingencies. It's a lack of contingencies.
But the contractors are quite good at inventing contingencies in order to bump the price up. I mean, we've seen this in, for example, IT contracts for the last 20 years.
Yeah. No, look. I know there have been some real practical issues being faced, and the contingencies have not been as robust as you would like. And that's because, say, in 2010, a lot of the capital contingencies were stripped out by central government. And it's not just a problem for us, it's a problem across the country. So when you find unexpecteds, it means the price goes up. Well, of course it does. But in 31 miles of route, 9 bridges and all those other things that we're doing, you know, to get that bang on target without any deviation, any additional cost, any delay in time, would be a miracle. And I've not seen it elsewhere.
I'll come back to this, the question I keep asking you, which is, when this all opens, are we going to be able to use day tickets for the city on the Metro bus?
Yes, so that's my expectation, that we're still talking to all the operators, so the potential operators for Metro bus and the people who operate all the other services, that actually people won't need to carry around a whole pocket full of tickets, so that one ticket will do your journey. And over time, rail as well. So I made my journey up here to Lawrence Hill, you know, in not so distant future, I'd like to see a position where I need one ticket rather than two, so to go by bus and by train. So we're fully integrated as a city.
Okay,
so that day is going to come.
First Group and Stagecoach are bidding. Who else?
I'm not telling you who the potential operators are, because it's commercially confidential, and it would be the wrong thing to do.
Would you like it if you had your own bus company, Bristol Bus Company, like we used to have in the old days, where you could just say, we don't have to negotiate all this with an outside contractor and cross our fingers behind our back. We can just say, OK, officers, this is the service we want for the people.
I would like the same powers in London, where they don't own a single bus, because buses are really expensive. But they operate a really complex network of several thousand buses. They don't own one bus, but every bus is the same, is recognisable, has the same ticketing system, the same fares and a common timetable. Now, that we will achieve through franchising if we get those new franchise powers, which I hope that we will in a couple of years' time.
Is there any prospect of that?
Yeah, because the bus services bill, if the government doesn't water it down, will be available in the next couple of years. Metro mayor authorities, like the one we're going to have here, will have first dibs on those new powers, and I think that would make a difference. So you could actually have a franchise operation, so not actually having to own the buses, and the bus is about £250,000 a throw, but actually, you know, real strong control over how that network operates. I think that would make a big difference.
Now, EMP for Filton and Bradley Stoke, Jack Lopresti, has called your roadworks shambolic, Mark. He's got a point, hasn't he?
I don't agree with him. I don't think his colleagues in South Gloucester should do either. I think what the position has been on the Ring Road, and of course the Ring Road is entirely within South Gloucester, is again, it needs lots of repairs and upgrades. So there are viaduct works at Bromley Heath, and there have been a whole series of other works that have been required. What we do need is to integrate the Ring Road into our wider road network, and that's work that the new Metro Mayor hopefully would take on board. We did persuade, and I supported my counterpart in South Gloss in persuading the Department for Transport not to start the works at Bromley Heath until the works on Stoke Lane were complete, and they've agreed to do that. But it's like the M32 in a way, you know, a very old road that needs a lot of upgrade.
So I think
Jack's wrong.
When is it all going to be finished on the M32 in the city centre anyway, finally?
Well, the M32, the Baldwin Street link should be in place very soon. Works are progressing, the piling's complete. There's some more road changes that we've just made this week. I think the M32 works, there's some more Highways England works, so I think those will be ongoing. The safety barrier needs to be replaced. That's really important work that needs doing, and Highways England need to get that done. So I would expect further works on the M32 during the course of this year.
So the city centre, when's that going to be sorted? I want at least a month. Come on, give us something to go on.
It won't be a month, and I'm really reticent, because whatever date I give you will be wrong.
May?
Because the contractors, you know, are doing their best to get the works done, and they're complicated works. I'd like to think that the works in the centre will be done by the summer, with some public realm works, so a bit of tidying up, pavement works and so on, to be completed by the end of this year. It might be a bit sooner than that. Obviously, weather gets in the way, but they're making good progress with the Baldwin Street link, and that's a really important piece of infrastructure. It's effectively a bridge over the Old Froome that will connect Baldwin Street up to Park Street. When that's in place, a lot of the diversions can be switched back. So that should happen next month.
So if it doesn't sort out the congestion in the city, this wonderful metro bus, are you going to bring in a congestion charge?
Well, I think that if we do bring in any future road user charging or anything like that, it would have to be in conjunction with our partner authorities and obviously the new Metro Mayor. At the moment, I want to get a more robust public transport network in our city. I want to see a step change in services. I want to make it easy for people to use those services. But of course, in our plans for the next 4 or 5 years, as a city region, we've shown that we need about £7.5 billion of investment over the next, over the period to about 2036. Question about where that's going to come from. So we expect central government to pay for some of that, but we may need to look for other sources of funding. Because if you look at the joint transport study that we've done, it's a ring of about 10 park and rides, rail improvements, junction improvements, light rail schemes, further metro bus. It's very, very expensive.
So is there any talk of a congestion charge? Because call me a cynic, but I think some people think that, well, no one really wants to fix this because they really love to bring in this way of taxing people more.
I'm not sure a congestion charge would be the best fit for the way that our city region is configured. You know, obviously it works in London because you've got the M25.
I mean, is anybody pushing for it, for example, in the business community?
I don't think so, but I think most people recognise there's a bit of a gap between what we need to get done as a city region and how much resource, even with the devolution deal. The devolution deal is, what, £30 million a year over a number of years. We're talking about £7.5 billion, and some people say that that's an underestimate of what we should be doing. So there's a bit of a gap between what we can do locally and what central government would be able to afford.
I don't want to give I don't want to give capita ideas, but this is what's happening up at the Seven Bridges, isn't it? Going to be cameras soon, which just take your number plate and then charge you to go over the Seven Bridge, even though the price is less than it is now. Of course, they're sacking a load of people. Everything's going over sort of robot charging, as is the case in London with the old Dartford Crossing as well. But, I mean, there are a lot of people who would love to just install a few cameras and charge us all, whatever it is, £2 or £3 a day to get in and out of the city, and as a way of punishing car users and trying to get them to use your metro bus.
I just want to see public transport improved. I want to see us better manage our congestion. And as I say, that does include working with SACLOS and other partners to make sure that the ring road is used to its maximum effect, but is fully integrated
well,
into our transport
metro
network.
Metro bus is a bit of a carrot, but are you prepared to use a stick as well to financially punish people that have to use the car?
I don't think it's about punishing, Tony.
Well, is it is. That's the way Londoners
well,
see it, a lot of them.
This is not London. I want to encourage people to see what the options are. And at the moment, for a lot of journeys, the car is the easiest and simplest way to make that journey, and I want to change that. And other cities have managed it. We can do the same. We've got a lot of positive energy in the city, and I think that that could really help us. But at the moment, far too many people feel that they've got to drive everywhere because there's no alternative.
OK, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers has been sitting very patiently here. Martin,
it's been quiet.
Yes, is it? Yes, very uncharacteristically quiet. Martin, would you like to chip in on this whole business of public transport? I put it to Mark just a minute ago about the idea that the old Bristol Bus Company or something along its lines might actually make a better job of this, enabling elected representatives to directly manage this rather than having to sort of juggle the balls with various unnamed secret contractors.
Well, I presume that we're not allowed to do that. Is that the reality? That we're not allowed to have? I mean, is there no option that for a public option to manage Metro Bus?
Not at the moment. And the government is keen to ban councils from operating their own bus companies. So those that currently have them would be exempt, but any new ones wouldn't be allowed.
Quick, get one started.
Well, it would be very difficult
just
to do one
route,
now.
Just one route, Mark. Come on, just one route. Get under the wire before they do that.
But I think franchising. I think franchising with all the powers it gives you over things like fares, it is probably where we want to be. And
wouldn't
so
you
do
rather directly manage something rather than have to deal with all the complaints the public are saying, oh, they're supposed to do this, they never do it?
I don't think I'd want to own a fleet of buses with all the costs involved.
Well,
with
that's
that.
Us owning it, not you.
Well, I don't think the city would want to own that.
I mean,
I think we
used to do it, and we used to make a very good job of it.
But
you talk to any of the old folks.
Well, I think the priorities now are just making sure that the bus services and public transport works well in the city, and it's not just a question of us owning a whole fleet of buses, because...
I mean, First Group nearly went bust, didn't they?
Well,
about 3 years ago. They nearly just... Well, you know, what is the situation then? Everyone gets up in the morning, oh, sorry, they've gone bust.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not very satisfactory, is
Can
it?
Can I just make another point? I mean, in the longer term, you might look towards... I believe Seattle in the United States has free public transport.
Oh.
Yeah. No, I know this is way blue sky utopianism in a way.
Well, not really.
But no, but I mean, if you weren't running things on a profit principle, you know, you could envisage in the long run doing something like that. And maybe we do need to start talking about things like that. They're talking about robots taking over car driving and so on. You know, in the long run, it's not unreasonable to talk about those blue skies things.
Have you been to Seattle?
That doesn't mean that's not threats.
Have you been to these various? Been to Cambridge?
It's not any use to us now in the constraints.
But
the fact is that local authorities don't have the powers to do these things because the central government prevents it.
Well, we just don't have the revenue either. With the scale of cuts that we're having to make, there's no way that I can pump more money into bus routes. What I want are the London-style powers, and other cities, because it's only London that has got them, we want the powers to control things like fares and routes and the type of vehicles. That would make a real difference to Bristol without us having to own a whole fleet of buses.
You mentioned the cuts there.
Yeah.
These cuts, how big are they? What sort of effect are they having, Mark? Because you've been a councillor for a while. Seems as if this is a bit of a biggie, isn't it?
I think this is the worst that I've experienced in terms of the scale, and you know, the latest cuts, and we've been consulting on our budget, and the council will meet in February, to decide on the budget for the coming year. But the scale of in-year cuts, the cuts that have to be made by the end of March this year, and then the subsequent cuts up until about 2021-22, you know, 92 million in that period on top of 150 million that has already gone. And, you know, it will make a really sharp impact in terms of what we can do.
So why aren't you raising the council tax to try and make, to keep services going?
Well, that is our proposal. That is our proposal, subject to the decision by council. But as a cabinet, and we presented to the Scrutiny Commission last night, is to raise council tax. Because, of course, part of that is trying to meet just a small proportion of the rising cost of adult
care. The trouble with council tax is that it falls massively on the poorest. People who are wealthy, this is peanuts for them when they're paying their council tax. It's a regressive tax.
Well, you seem to just advocate increasing the council tax.
No, I'm saying, I asked, are you? Because, I mean, you've got to get the money from somewhere. It's just that it seems that the government is strong-arming local authorities into doing this thing where they're increasing the council tax, where the poor are having to pay and the rich aren't. We've got $31 billion. We had a thing from the Evening Post a couple of months ago, looking at the rich list. The top 20 have got £31 billion of rich people who live in the Bristol area, including Mr Dyson, etc. If they were to lose half of their individual wealth, say they're worth £2 billion each, if they were to lose half of that, would even hardly notice it. They wouldn't like it, but these are surely the people who should be paying for these massive government cuts.
Well, council tax is a national scheme, so we don't have much flexibility over how it's applied, but we are proposing a number of changes. So, for example, to end the council tax discount on homes which are left empty. So we want to do that, but we also want to keep in place what's known as the council tax reduction scheme, so the poorest people have some help and protection in terms of council tax increases. And I think we're the only authority in England, I might be wrong on that, that's actually kept this going.
We're talking about people with no money, Mark, aren't we, at all? I mean, we're talking about people who are just going into debt, even if they may be working.
I think the council tax reduction scheme, which is really, really expensive, does help those people who are poorest meet the council tax bills. Without it, they would face a bigger burden, and I think we are alone in the core cities in having kept that going. And it's a decision that we have made as the administration. It is a priority for us, obviously subject to the decision of full council. But there is no beating around the bush. This is a really difficult time for us. We have to reinvent what we do, and we have to focus on, you know, where we can make the biggest difference as a council, and maybe stop doing a whole range of other things. And as a portfolio holder, you know, I've been party to a lot of conversations, and really difficult, you know, prioritisation of things that
this is
you know you want to do as a city, but you can't afford to do anymore.
This is something which, I mean, is central government, isn't it? And if you have a look, actually, at the last election, what is it? It's coming on for 2 years ago now, the last general election. We've got 29-30 constituencies where the Conservatives have fraudulent, it looks certainly evidence that there's fraudulent returns for those constituencies. And the Electoral Commission has been looking at this and looking at this and looking at this. Well, they've made complaints about the Labour Party's spending in that election over the bus, some sort of bus or... Oh, no, hang on. It was the a big tablet of stone or something. Anyway, the point being of Ed Miliband's failed tablet of stone. But the point being here, the government's majority is only around about, I think it's about 8 or 9 now. I mean, what is going on where you've got police investigations into these elections and election spending and fraud, and yet nothing is really sort of said about it. It goes on and on and on, and you've got a government which almost looks as if it shouldn't really be there.
As you said, these are in some cases ongoing police investigations, so it'd be wrong for me to comment, but these cuts are down to government policy. The government has told us we need to make these cuts, so cuts to the NHS, and my colleague Jill Kirk made a really impassioned plea at the council meeting this week about the scale of NHS cuts that we're facing, over 300 million in our area, but actually the impact of all these cuts, and in Bristol's case, you know, 30 to 40 million pounds in year and 92 million in the period to 2021. This is going to make a big difference, and there's no way of avoiding it other than to prioritise those things that we really must do as a council and those things that we can do well, work with our partners in the city and try and get the biggest impact that we can.
Well, fingers crossed.
But there's no avoiding it, I'm afraid.
Martin Summers, what about this issue over the election? Because we've still got these outstanding police investigations in 30 constituencies, Conservative, all of them, where the Conservative Central Office was spending vast amounts of money in these local constituencies but never declared it. And they've gone bust in apparently 30 different constituencies where you have to submit a return. We spent this much in this constituency and they have just not told the truth.
Yeah, and as you say, the Labour Party were fined, weren't they, for overspending in some constituencies, and the Conservative Party is under investigation. I think even more worrying than that...
Yes, MP have been, yeah, as have UKIP, but yeah. never the Conservatives, even though they seem to be the biggest offenders.
We know that the law is not always impartially enforced, but what really worries me...
Are you saying the police are favouring the Conservative Party?
No, it's just investigating. People who have political power have ways to protect themselves. It's always been that way, and it still is. What worries me even more is the Tories' proposals to redraw constituency boundaries, reducing the number of MPs... even though they've actually increased the numbers of the House of Lords. Apparently there's not enough MPs, there's too many MPs, and we're going to save money by reducing them. So they're going to redraw constituency boundaries. But those constituency boundaries will be redrawn on the existing electoral registers, which we know from working in inner city areas are massively underrepresenting inner city populations. So not only the inner city populations be disenfranchised, the new constituency boundaries will favour the leafy suburbs. And under a first-past-the-post electoral system, that means that a Labour Party, which is already struggling to make its mark, will have a virtually impossible uphill climb. Yep. To win a general
election. The picture
election.
Martin's painting there is gerrymandering, really, isn't it?
There's no doubt that urban constituencies are going to have, are going to face the biggest impact of this redrawing of the boundaries. And it's quite a blatant attempt, I think, to skew the way our democracy actually works. And, we have all tried over the years to get more people to register to vote, but it is an ongoing challenge. And where you have people living at an address for a very short period of time, well, I've had this conversation on the doorstep. People, didn't realise they had to register again, or they didn't realise they had to register, or they thought it was linked in some way to their council tax or whatever. There's a lot of confusion out there. And, of course, increasingly people just think, well, my polling card's got lost in the post. They don't realise they're not actually entitled to vote because they haven't registered.
Well, when you mentioned council tax there, that was in fact, originally it was the poll tax which became the council tax. And the purpose of that was to make poor people directly responsible for paying for whatever services they voted for. And of course, if there's one part of the United Kingdom where they don't have council tax, and that's Northern Ireland, where they still have the rates, the rating system, which was put in place originally by Elizabeth I and then got rid of by Margaret Thatcher. But of course, they didn't introduce the council tax and the poll tax in Northern Ireland because of the kind of rioting that you'd seen in Britain around that was just, it was incomprehensible. The Falls Road and the Shankill Road would have gone up.
Mark, I just wonder whether you feel sometimes like a bit of an enforcer for central government.
I think, we have strong duties as a public authority to set a balanced budget, but there's no denying the fact that central government is passing more and more responsibility to the local level, and we're not getting the resources that we need to do the job. And by 2020, the level of direct grant from central government will all but dry up, so we will be almost entirely dependent on council tax and business rate. So all the grant that we've been used to as authorities to fund key areas of our activities will seize up. So council tax and business rate will be the two areas where we derive most of our income.
Why should anybody vote for the Labour Party here in Bristol if all you're doing is implementing Conservative cuts from Westminster?
We have a legal duty set a balanced budget. Our leader has reaffirmed that. And we have to do the best deal for this city. And I tell you, it's far better you have a Labour administration in charge in terms of our priorities and what we're trying to do, as opposed to another party in charge. But this is not what I signed up for. I don't think it's what any of us signed up for. But we have to protect the poorest, the most vulnerable people in the city. And, as I say, prioritise the services that we can do well, that no one else can do, and actually work with partners in the public sector and elsewhere to ensure that other things get done. And increasingly to work across boundary. You know, particularly on things like transport and building new homes, it is that cross-boundary agenda which is really, really important to us.
OK, on to some news from the week. Robots will take over most jobs within 30 years, warn experts. This is in the Daily Telegraph, actually from last year, I think. Sarah Napton. Robots will have taken over most jobs within 30 years, leaving humanity facing its biggest challenge ever, to find meaning in life when work is no longer necessary, according to experts. Professor Moshe Vardy of Rice University in the US claims many middle-class professionals will be outsourced to machines within the next few decades, leaving workers with more leisure time than they have ever experienced. Well, leisure time, but maybe no money. Martin, this is if we don't own these machines, we're going to starve, aren't we?
Well, this is a fundamental question, isn't it? This is why capitalism is a system which has got great potential, but also potential for crisis. Because if you exclude people from paid work, which is effectively what you're doing, and certainly the collapse of manufacturing industry has created a huge problem, because manufacturing used to provide relatively high wages for relatively lowly skilled people. And when it went, you've got this much bigger inequality of incomes developing. And if you get to the point where you've actually got rid of the workforce, you're also getting rid of the customers that the capitalists need to sell their stuff. So what you get round that by lending people money and blowing financial asset bubbles, we're already there. And then they crash. And then wars break out as people lose, you know, their sense of proportion. And then, you know, we end up in, you know, it's the 1930s on steroids problem. That's what we're up against.
Mark, Professor Moshe Vardy is saying we're approaching a time where machines will be able to outperform humans at almost any task. Humanity is about to face perhaps its greatest challenge ever, which is finding meaning in life after the end of "In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread." We need to rise to the occasion and meet this challenge before human labour becomes obsolete.
I don't know whether this is a bit of sci-fi or what, because, you know, humans like interacting with other human beings, and despite all the attempts, a robot, whilst it may, you know, have some characteristics which are very similar to human behaviour, including speech and so on, You just won't have that same interaction. So I just wonder if there's a point where it will just end naturally. I do think that some of the advances, particularly in things like surgery, where robotics are being used, are quite fascinating. And they are altering the life chances of some people who are seriously injured or need some very specialist surgery. And obviously in the area of telecommunications, you know, my mobile phone probably has more computing capacity than, you know, in the 1960s, three floors of a building. So we do benefit from this to a certain extent. But I think it's the human interaction bit which will act as a barrier to this going too far.
Don't you think we're heading towards a time when there's a sort of elite of super wealthy? We're talking about these the 31 billion of the 20 richest in round Bristol, and a whole kind of underclass of people who are working or on benefits and have got virtually nothing or are simply in debt, and, you know, a bigger, you know, an increasing underclass. We're already seeing it developing.
I think indebtedness is a worry, and the governor of the Bank of England has made some comments on this in the last couple of weeks about the level of personal debt, which is rising again in very uncertain times with Brexit, and I had to mention it at least once. But also, you know, we see today that retail sales fell very sharply over the Christmas period. So I think on the one hand, there's an attempt to present, you know, post-June last year as being rosy, but actually our economy is still very unstable and subject to some potentially profound shocks. So the levels of personal indebtedness and the risks around that, I think, is something that, you know, I'm certainly concerned around, and government should certainly take much more interest
in. Martin, an underclass is developing, isn't it? I don't think there's much denying it, really.
No, there isn't. And don't forget, we've been keeping the whole financial system has been on life support since 2008 with quantitative easing and virtually zero interest rates. That's not supposed to happen. That's not in the textbook. So one of the responses to Brexit by Mark Carney was to switch on the quantitative easing button again. Now, we don't know how far they can go with quantitative easing. Nomi Prins, who used to be an investment banker, was interviewed the other week, and she's predicting, she said it's very hard to predict when the crash will happen, because quantitative easing, you know, the European Central Bank at one stage was not going to do quantitative easing.
If there's a shock, and then they did. Okay, surely there'll just be another bailout. That's what.
Well, no, because ultimately the problem is that because of 2008, the states, states all over the world have become insolvent because of the bailouts. So if there's another crash, and I think there will be another crash, it's only a question of when. I can't see any. I mean, it's not as if, will there be a crash? Of course there will be a crash. We've got the biggest financial bubble in history, which has been stoked up by these unconventional monetary policies, which are not supposed to be used at all. When quantitative easing was first brought in, it was regarded as a temporary measure which will last for a few months. It's been going for, you know, 8 years plus now. And that is, and it's led to a huge speculative bubble in financial markets. Donald Trump, before he was elected, said that the stock market in the US was in a bubble mode, and now it's actually gone through the roof because of the feeling, because of the belief that he's going to spend a load of money and stimulate things. This is all fool's gold.
Okay, before we hear from Mark Bradshaw on this, Labour Bedminster councillor and does transport on the Cabinet, let's go to the House of Commons on Wednesday, where Angus Robertson, the SNP leader in the Commons, was talking about this very subject, the economics of Brexit.
Scotland's leading economic forecaster says, and I quote, that real wages will fall...
They don't like experts.
Tories jeering and cheering when the forecast for people's income is it is as likely to drop by £2,000 and that 80,000... Mr. Speaker, that 80,000 people may lose their jobs in Scotland as a result of the hard Tory Brexit plan of the Prime Minister. Does the Prime Minister believe that this is a price worth paying for her Little Britain Brexit?
I repeat what I said earlier. We will be working to ensure that we get the best possible deal in terms of access to the single market and continuing to cooperate in partnership with the member states of the remaining 27 member states of the European Union. But the Right Honourable Gentleman once again talks about the possibility of a negative impact on Scotland if Scotland were not part of the single market. His party is dedicated to taking Scotland out of the single market by taking it out for the United Kingdom.
I think she meant to say kingdom there, Martin.
Well, it's pretty bizarre mudslinging, isn't it? It's not clear.
The point really here is that there's some economists, like the IMF, that actually increased Britain's growth forecast, and there's Angus Robertson and his best economist in Scotland is saying, oh, we're going to lose loads of jobs. So, you can understand why people may be a bit confused.
To be honest, forecasting is actually not a precise science, as anybody will tell you. And in fact, you can't really forecast what's going to happen or when it's going to happen. I would see Brexit as creating more uncertainty in the international market, not just for Britain, We've still got, you know, there's a whole load of dominoes to fall in southern Europe. Greece is in trouble again. Portugal's in trouble again. Italy's wobbling. And, of course, when these, if there is a general financial crisis, the City of London will be at the centre of it, whether we are in or out of the European Union. And I firmly predict, I'm pretty confident about this, that this crisis and crash will happen before Britain leaves the European Union. And once it happens, being in or out of the European Union, suddenly people realise actually it doesn't matter that much.
You've extended your prediction you made in whatever it was, 2009, another 2 years.
No, well, Brexit is going to take a very long time to negotiate.
Like George Osborne.
I think everybody agrees that
when he was saying that we balanced the books by 2020, he kept extending that, didn't he? So, I mean, this crash, what?
Well, listen, a crash of the kind I'm talking about, Tony, by definition, only happens once. There was no crash in the international markets between 1890 and 1929. That took a long time. And what you've got now, because of the financial intervention, is instead of having little crashes and then little booms and then little crashes, which is the model of the 19th century, because of the interconnectedness of the financial system, crashes are rare, but they are catastrophic when they happen. And I'm actually in tune with the von Mises Institute and the other right-wing, serious right-wing market economists who predict a crash, as I do, as a Marxist. We've got a shared view of it.
So in what way is the economic policy being used politically?
Well, it's being used politically because what we're doing is we're bailing out the failed banking system, which should have been dismantled. And, I mean, Obama had 8 years to clean house in Wall Street. He didn't do it. Donald Trump has got no intention of doing it. He is actually encouraging the bubble to carry on bubbling. But, of course, I've read analysis of what he's proposing to do, which simply won't work.
What power exactly do these banks have over politicians? Surely your politicians should be able to tell them what to do.
Well, the opportunity to do that was in 2008. And fluffed it.
Gordon Brown.
Well, no, it wasn't
anyway,
just look, Gordon Brown. They all fluffed it.
Let's let Mark Bradshaw have his say on the Brexit and on Trump, if you wish, Mark.
I'm just glad I'm not an economist. I think there is a kind of anti-expert sentiment, and I think it's unfortunate because there is a temptation not to listen to people who have experience, who have knowledge.
But don't people employ the experts that they want? Give them the answers that they want.
Well, I think that post-Brexit, we still, you know, live in really uncertain times, and the economic indicators are all over the place. And I mentioned the retail sales over Christmas, taking a bit of a nose dive. As for Trump, well, I don't know where to start. Perhaps there's not enough time left, but let's see how he turns out. But I think, you know, if he continues to conduct from policy via Twitter.
Trump's point is that people like the Washington Post and New York Times just don't report him accurately. He's got to go direct to the masses through social media.
Well, I'm afraid that some of the tweeting I've seen is somewhat extreme and unstable, but let's see how he turns out when he sits down at that desk in the Oval Office. But I'm not looking forward to the next 4 years.
Talking of the media, we mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. Maybe it was even last week. This week it's bubbled up to the news again because the BBC trusts were vacillating. Laura Koonsberg inaccurately represented Jeremy Corbyn on Shoot to Kill. So they interviewed him, giving him one question, and then they put him on the 6 o'clock news where she voiced a completely different question that he'd never even been asked. And Shoot to Kill is quite an important policy, isn't it? It's national security.
Indeed. I think it's why that we have an unbiased media, that people trust the reporting that is out there.
I mean, that's fake news, isn't it, on the BBC 6 o'clock news?
Well, I just think it's really important that people trust the news, are in a position to trust the news, to trust the information out there.
Do you?
It's really critical.
Do you?
I have a certain degree of trust in the news that I see, but I don't believe it all, particularly the stuff that's written about me.
And particularly this show as well, of course. Don't trust us. Check for yourself, folks. Time for the Murdoch News at 6. We've got a geopolitical analyst, a military analyst from the UN, talking about Trump after the news.
On your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.